time, we ended with BF-type formulations, and I covered some field redefinitions. It was very quick, so probably impossible to follow. So I want to slow it down and also explain why I care about this. The plan for today is that I will end these BF-type formulations in about maybe 20 minutes and then start talking about chiral formulations. So most of today will be on chiral formulations of GR, which are very beautiful, is very beautiful geometry. There is a lot to talk about there. So I was asked after yesterday's lecture, it wasn't clear why in the pure connection formulation it was possible to exchange. So the pure connection formulation gave it gave this trace square root, and there was a square root of epsilon x square root of epsilon under the trace. Why was it okay to exchange cyclically permute this square root of epsilon factor under the square root? Well, the explanation is here. Actually, it's a proof of the fact that trace square root of product of two matrices, you can permute these two matrices under the square root. This has to do with the fact that, well, we can freely insert mm minus 1 under the trace. That's just the usual cyclicity of the trace. But then, because operation of taking square root commutes with similarity transformations, actually it's true that a minus 1 square root of BA is the same as the square root of a minus 1 BA. That's very simple to check. And so we can just take this m minus 1 m under the square root, but not as square roots of m, which is literally, it's a similarity transformation on the square root. It's the same as the square root of a similarity transformation. And then this gives you the explanation why it's okay to commute things.
You mean the square root of A?
What do I mean? Yeah. No, actually here in this, what I've circled, this is not the square root of A. So for matrices, yeah, these are matrices. These are not numbers. So actually, this is true. Well, you just check it. So for example, if you multiply this thing twice on itself, what you get is, well, maybe we should do it on the board. This is surprising relation, yeah, when you see it for the first time. So let me take A minus 1 square root of B, A squared, which is A minus 1 square root of B, A minus 1 square root of B, A, which is A minus 1, B, A. Right? So this is indeed, this thing is the square root of this thing. Okay, so this is some technical clarification for what we covered yesterday. Then I want to explain why I care about these field definitions that I started last time. And the explanation is that we were considering BF-type Lagrangians of this form. So it's B, curvature of the spin connection, some matrix M sitting in front of BB, and then some condition imposed on the matrix M. For the case of GR, it was a trace of M, where a trace is computed using the epsilon. It's really trace. Well, it's a contraction of M with epsilon. This trace is required to be a constant with a Lagrange multiplier. But it's clear that we can consider similar type of theories in which we change this function into something else. We can modify the theory in a very simple way by changing the function. So as I discussed already, it's easy to change the function into two parameter family, in which instead of trace being contraction of M with epsilon, you consider a more general contraction. This still gives you GR, but one can do more. There are, of course, many more gauge invariant, Lorentz invariant functions that you can construct out of a matrix. In particular, you can consider something like trace M squared or trace M squared with insertions of epsilon or determinant M. There is a really very many functions one can write. There is actually an infinite parameter family of functions one can write here. And so it's very easy to modify these BF type of formulations of GR by modifying what this function F is. This has been studied in the literature. As you expect, this modifies the theory drastically. It's no longer GR. It introduces new degrees of freedom. And well, this has been studied about 10 years ago by Smolin, Speciali, and other people. And it was shown that generically, this describes bigravity. There are actually two metrics propagating instead of one. So by changing the function f, you change the character of the theory drastically. And then it's very interesting that there is a two-parameter family of choices of f, which I will describe. It comes from these field definitions that still gives GR, but the function f is very different from what it is in the formulations we're used to. So that, yes.
When you say it generically becomes bigravity, does it become the ghost-free?
Generically, it becomes the one with a ghost. Yeah, it doesn't become any.
There must be special choices that give.
That has not been studied very well. Yeah, there can be, but as far as I know, well, what people have shown that generically is just bigravity with two sets of metrics. One is massless, one is massive. People kind of left it there. Okay, so let me now explain these field definitions more slowly. But the idea of field definition is that you get the formulation of BF type with a function f, which looks very different from what it is in GR, but it still describes GR, and this is what is surprising about it. As I said, the idea is that you start mixing B with the curvature. You introduce two matrices. And maybe I should explain the notation here, because it's not obviously. So B IJ is a Lie algebra object, Lie algebra valued object. So I'm thinking about it as a vector in value with values in Lie algebra. With values in SO13. Similarly, B tilde and R. Well, because they have this pair of indices ij, anti-symmetric pair of indices ij, they are all vectors with values in Lie algebra. Matrix G is of the type ijkl, so and the same with H, hijkl, and they are not necessarily symmetric; they're just matrices, 6 by 6. So Lie algebra times Lie algebra. They act on vectors in Lie algebra and give you element of Lie algebra back. And so this is the notation now makes sense. B is vector in the Lie algebra. Here is a matrix which acts on B tilde, gives you another vector in Lie algebra, and similarly here. And when I want to take a trace, I write transpose. So for example, RTR is just Rij, Rij in index notations. And this guy, Rt epsilon r, is Rij, sorry, it's Rij, epsilon ij kl, rkl. So epsilon is a matrix, r and b are vectors. Okay, and then the idea of field definition, it's designed so that, maybe I should write it on the board. What we do, the original Lagrangian is BR plus half, maybe minus half, T, BT, MB, plus some constraint on matrix M. And now I'm replacing B, becomes G, B tilde, plus HR. So this Lagrangian goes, well, it's equal to, well, actually, this is B is equal to, so the Lagrangian is equal to G, well, there is also transpose, so I should be more careful. It's B tilde transpose, G transpose, plus R transpose, H transpose, all multiplying R, plus or minus, and let me try to erase it. It's the front, so minus a half, and then I again substitute this B here. So it's B tilde transpose G transpose plus R transpose H transpose matrix M, and then G B tilde plus H R. And then you start collecting various terms. Of course, it's clear that there are R-squared terms. Well, R-squared terms is this, and, well, one is coming from this. And there is also BR terms, as in the original Lagrangian, and of course there is BB terms. So you just collect all this. There are some matrices appearing in front of all these terms. And what you want the matrix in front of R squared term to be just a sum, arbitrarily linear combination of identity matrix and the epsilon, because this gives you these two topological terms. And then you want the matrix in front of BR to be just the identity, to continue being identity matrix. You don't want to change the BF form of the Lagrangian. So this gives these two equations. They can be read from here. So for example, well, in the R squared term, it's clear that H appears there, and this is my first term. And there is also HTMH. This is my second term. And I want it to be T. And similarly, well, for the matrix in front of BR is this guy, I want it to be the identity. You write these two matrix equations. These are two equations on H and G. You solve them with various manipulations involving matrices. These are the solutions. And then you call the new matrix. So there will be a term BT tilde, some big matrix M tilde, B tilde. And of course, this matrix M tilde will involve the M and G and H. And well, the computation gives you this. The old M is related to M tilde in this way. And you want the old M in terms of new M, because the condition, we had the constraint, it was imposed on the old M. So we will be re-expressing the constraint as a constraint on the new M. So after all that, what you get is this action. It the form is unchanged. It's BTR minus BTMB, and I remove the tildes now. So this is actually what I've done. I've just rewrote the old action. It's the same action in front of tilde variables. So actually, there are tildes everywhere, which I removed. There is R squared term, but by design, this R squared term is just a topological term. It doesn't change anything. But effect of all this transformation is that the constraint that we're imposing on this matrix sitting in front of BB has changed. So in effect, what we've done, we get a new Lagrangian of the same type, but where the function that appears in the constraint has changed. So now we have FGR is equal to, it used to be just the trace of epsilon M. Now this is trace of epsilon M, and there is one identity matrix plus 2tm to the minus 1. So the function has changed completely. It now becomes a two-parameter family of functions. For t1, t2 equal to 0, it becomes the previous function, the one that we're used to, the one that gives us, the one that constrains the trace of m, the usual trace of m, to be constant. And that gives us the familiar BF formalism with constraints. But now this function has changed. In particular, there are no constraints anymore. The new Bs, the redefined Bs, they do not satisfy the metricity constraints anymore, simply because the constraint that is imposed on the function on the matrix M now. Previously, this constraint was, as I said, trace, well, Mij kl epsilon ij kl is for lambda, let's say, or maybe, yeah, for lambda. And this meant that Mij kl is of the form some psi ij kl, which is trace free plus some lambda over something. Epsilon ijkl. And varying with respect to this part of M, we got the metricity constraint. Now this is gone. The new matrix M is no longer, well, the new constraint is not this. The new matrix M is not of this form. And there are no metricity constraints anymore. Okay, so which is rather surprising that it's possible. And it will become even more surprising in the next step. What I want to do in the next step, I want to integrate out the Lagrange multipliers. In the previous formulation, the formulation with simplicity constraints, this Lagrange multiplier field is there in the action, and it cannot be integrated out because action depends linearly on it. Now this becomes possible. So this is what I'll do in the next step. I'll call it BF type formulation with a potential for the two form field, because all Lagrange multiplier fields will be eliminated. So we'll get a pure BF type action with no other fields apart from B and the spin connection. The idea is that we take this Lagrangian, vary it with respect to M first. We want to find an equation for M and solve it. This equation for M is this one here, where XB is the matrix of wedge products of B with itself. We solve this equation. The solution is written, well, after multiplying with bunches of square roots of T, the solution arises as a solution for this combination first. That's a solution. I'm using the same trick as I used yesterday. It's a very similar type of equation that appears in the road to pure connection formalism. It's a very similar type of equation. I need to find, you see, I have something like, I need to find something involving square roots, it's clear, because on the left-hand side of the equation, matrix M appears twice. And well, so the solution is this. One then determines M, then determines the square root of mu from the constraint, and this other Lagrange multiplier. And the final arising action is this. All the Lagrange multiplier fields are gone. Matrix M, mu are gone. It's pure BF type action. Its action is a function of the two-form field, spin connection. It is of BF type. The kinetic term is just BF. The first line here in this action is a topological action, because BF plus, remember this guy is just identity matrix and epsilon. So this is a topological action. Topological. And what makes it not topological is this additional term. This involves a square root of a complicated sort. And so one can think about this formalism as BF plus a potential for the B field. These two terms form a potential for the B field. And the fact that such a formulation is possible is not at all obvious. Remember that in the people who do spin foams, we know that there is a BF-type formalism for gravity where you need to impose constraints on B. If you don't have constraints on B, this is not gravity. Well, here is a BF-type formalism without any constraints on the B. All of B is present in the action. You don't need to kill any components of it to have gravity. All of B, one can say, propagates. Of course, the number of propagating degrees of freedom here is unchanged, it's still 2. So most of these fields that are there are eliminated by some second-class constraints, by algebraic equations. But there are no explicit constraints that you need to impose on the B, which is amazing. It's amazing that this is possible. I think, I'm not sure that this action is useful in applications, but I think the fact that it is possible is by itself surprising, and it should be known, should be kept in mind. And the last comment that I want to make is that it's possible to do even obtain even stranger formalism, because, well, this is, yes?
For tip of the arbitrary linear combination of identity and epsilon,
yes.
What does it mean for this action? It means we can still choose the linear combination? So
yes, yeah. So actually this is a two-parameter family of actions.
Does it depend on the dynamics of, it doesn't depend on how we choose t, but then we I mean, in the denominator, let's say.
You cannot put t to zero. The section will blow up if you try to do that. So that is not an option. But for any finite value of t, it's possible. Okay, and the last transformation I want to do is, you see, this is BF type action. Therefore, this is first order formalism. I can now integrate out the connection and obtain a pure second order formalism for the B field. So let me show how this is done. This has not been done in the literature. It is possible, but just nobody cared about this, but this is possible. So what you do, when you vary the Lagrangian, well, BF Lagrangian with respect to the connection, you get this this equation. Cavarian derivative of the B field with respect to the connection is zero. And the number of equations that you have here matches the number of unknown connection components. Well, because here we have, it's a three form with values in the Lie algebra. So the number of equations is 4 times 6. And the number of connection components is the same. So this gives you reasonable hope that there is a unique solution whenever B is appropriately non-degenerate. I don't think anybody wrote down this solution, but I'm sure it's possible to do. And then substituting this solution back into the action would give you second order formalism with only the B in it. So it would be just the theory of propagating two-form field. And yes?
Can you do similar manipulations for ordinary gauge theories?
For ordinary gauge theories, this is more tricky. There is definitely first order formalism, right? There is BF plus B. Well, star B, or well, let's say B squared computed using the metric. No, I think it, let me think. So this is Lie algebra valued object, right? Both are Lie algebra valued, and then the equation you will get is d A B A. It's a Cavarian derivative for B is equal to zero. It's still the algebra valued one form. Well, but you see, this guy may not be non-degenerate in the form you want in order to be able to solve this equation. So this I'm not sure about if it's possible.
Well, if you go back a slide, is there a similar, before you try to integrate it?
Yes. What's the question?
Before. Is there an analog of this for ordinary gauge theory, or?
Well, yes, that's the analog. Yes.
So the first line, yeah.
The first line here is, it's the first order formalism for any ordinary gauge theory. That exists. It's very easy to integrate B out and get back the usual connection second order formalism, but, well, there may be papers on thinking about this.
I was interested in whether there was the analog of this potential.
Well, the potential is here. It's already BF type formalism with a potential for the B.
You don't have Lagrange multipliers, so you don't. You wouldn't integrate them out here, so it's already the B squared.
You don't have any constraints.
This is analog of that, I think so. This is BF plus potential for the B, this is BF plus potential for the B. Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, I don't know. It seems that this is, at least the number of equation here matches the number of unknown connections. And now that I'm thinking about it, I probably have seen papers attempting to do this, but I don't know what the end result is. Well, maybe you know more about this. Thinking about this dual variable, B in gauge theory, as the main variable.
For SU2, people have tried.
For SU2, people. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so.
Is it true that the full, you're calling the B squared thing a potential? Is that still topological?
No, it's B mu squared. A. There is a metric involved here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not B wedge B. It's. Metric is involved. Yeah, of course, in there is no metric.
Okay.
And you see the way it's constructed, the potential is just constructed out of wedge products of B's with B's, and this is why you need a square root, because without the square root, you cannot get anything non-topological. Okay, so there is this possibility of having a very strange formalism in which just B propagates, so to say. There is a it's second order theory of the B field. Okay. So now I switch to the self-dual case or chiral story. And this will occupy us till the end. So this is maybe the least familiar set of formalisms, at least for people who are not familiar with loop quantum gravity. This is probably not familiar at all. These formalisms, yes?
Could I ask one more question about the pure B formulation? So you don't have the connection anymore, so it's like, what is the geometric interpretation of the B field?
It's a good question. It describes two metrics. Plus other stuff. Just by counting, B has 36 components. So it describes two metrics. This is 20 plus other stuff, which I don't know how to interpret.
Okay, but
geometric interpretation is not easy. And definitely it involves two metrics. That's part of geometric interpretation. Because one can arrive to geometric interpretation by splitting B into self-dual, anti-self-dual pieces. And then one knows that, for example, the self-dual piece describes a metric plus other stuff. The self-dual part can be interpreted. And then the anti-self-dual will also describe another metric plus some other stuff. And then so it's a theory of two metrics plus other auxiliary fields.
Okay. And it's just constructed so that one of the metrics isn't really there or something.
Yeah, the other metric will be eliminated by some second-class constraints, by algebraic equations, yeah. It's not at all economic description of GR with its two propagating degrees of freedom. You have 36 fields there, so it's not a good idea to do that in practice, but in principle it's possible. Okay, so we talk about chiral formalisms. They are all specific to four space-time dimensions. You'll see that they're based on self-duality, on Hodge, so this is now, it becomes a four-dimensional story. Some of the formalism that I talked about before could be done, for example, Einstein-Cartan. This exists in any dimension. These BF-type formalisms are also four-dimensional. But this becomes even more four-dimensional because it involves the Hodge star. There is probably something very deep going on in this formalism because the geometry, you will see that the geometry that they're based on is rather deep. And I personally think that there is, if any of the formalisms have potential for generalizations into unknown, then these chiral formalisms probably have more potential because there is something very, very interesting going on. The nature of soldering changes in these formalisms in a deep, not obvious way, which I'll try to explain. First, I will start by explaining why such chiral formulations can be possible. At the most fundamental level, they have to do with the fact that in 4D, the Lorentz group is not simple. Depending on the signature, Lie algebra of Lorentz splits into two commuting copies. So for SO4, this is the easiest. These are just two commuting SU2s. For the Lorentz group, this is SL to C plus its complex conjugate. And for SO to 2, these are two commuting SL to R Lie algebras. So this means that because spin connection is a Lorentz valued connection, it's good to think about spin connection as a sum of its self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Because this split is naturally, it's automatically there. Lie algebra splits. So it suggests that we should split the spin connection in these two parts. And then you maybe remember the remark that I was making about the full spin connection formalism. I was saying that first order formalism, Einstein-Cartan, is like a Hamiltonian formalism in which spin connection plays the role of momenta variables. They're integrated in to make field equations first order, but there are too many of them. But now we have a opportunity to work with less variables because, the connection splits, and actually the idea of this chiral formalism is that it will be enough to keep only half of it, completely enough in the sense that, enough in the sense of this idea of integrating in momenta variables. In the full non-chiral formalism, we integrate in full spin connection, But we'll see that it's enough to integrate in half of it, and we will have equivalent formalism. Okay, so this is conceptually one explanation why something like that might be true, but now I want to provide more concrete explanation. So in any dimension, a Riemann tensor splits into its different irreducible with respect to Lorentz group components. They're called the Weyl, the Ricci, and the Ricci scalar, right? This is true in any dimension. In four dimensions, there is another decomposition of the Riemann tensor. It arises, well, I'll explain it, but it's related to the self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition. It's a decomposition that is only available in four dimensions. And of course, it's not surprising that it's really the same decomposition. So decomposing into self-dual, anti-self-dual parts, you recover decomposition into Weyl, Ricci part, and the Ricci scalar. It's really the same. These two decompositions encode the same information in a different way. And because Einstein equations, at least in vacuum, can be stated as the trace free part of Ricci is equal to zero, right? Einstein equations in vacuum are R mu nu is equal to lambda G mu nu, which is the same as R only has the trace part, which is the same as the trace free part of R is equal to zero. So because Einstein equation is just a condition that part of this decomposition of Riemann is zero, and we can get into parts of Riemann by doing self-dual, anti-self-dual decompositions. This means that we have a completely new, specific only to 4D way to encode Einstein condition. It will be related to self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition. So in details, how does it work? Let's consider the Hodge operator of a given metric. It all starts with the usual story. We have a metric, and then we just think about Riemann. So first of all, the Hodge maps two forms to two forms. It is this operator. If you square the Hodge, it squares to plus minus identity depending on the signature. So my Hodge squared is sigma identity, where sigma is plus one in Euclidean and split signatures, and minus one in the Lorentzian signature. Now we look at the eigenspaces of the Hodge operator. So lambda two splits into eigenspaces, which we call lambda plus, lambda minus. We call them self and anti-self dual two forms. So self dual two form has the property that if you take a Hodge, it gives you plus square root of sigma self, the same self dual two form. So it's an eigenvector of eigenvalue plus square root of sigma. And you see that in Lorentzian signature, self-dual and anti-self-dual objects are necessarily complex because of the square root of sigma. And so actually in Lorentzian signature, these eigenspaces are complex, and if we want to decompose a real vector, then, well, it decomposes into two complex vectors, one of which is the complex conjugate of the other. This is as what happens for complex structures. So one sometimes say that in Lorentzian signature, the Hodge gives you a complex structure on the space of two forms. And it's very interesting and maybe or probably deep fact that there is a relation, there seems to be a relation between necessity of using complex objects, complex numbers, and Lorentzian signature. Lorentzian signature, via this self-duality, it tells us that Lorentzian signature means I square root of minus one. We live in Lorentzian signature and we use I's all over the place, in particular in quantum mechanics. So, well, there is a relation between them. So let me denote by P plus minus the projectors on self-dual, anti-self-dual two forms. They're projectors on lambda plus minus. Then any two form can be represented as a sum of its self-dual, anti-self-dual parts. The B plus minus, of course, are just projectors applied to B. In Lorentzian signature, as I said, if you start with a real two form, then its self-dual, anti-self-dual parts will be complex conjugates of each other. And there is no relation between lambda plus and lambda minus in other signatures. Now, with this decomposition of lambda 2 of the space of two forms in mind, we will think about Riemann as a map from lambda 2 to lambda 2. Right? We just raise the indices of Riemann. We know that Riemann of a torsion-free metric connection, it has the property that it's anti-symmetric in these two indices, anti-symmetric in these two, and symmetric under the exchange. And there is additional full anti-symmetrization vanishes. These are all the properties of Riemann. But in particular, we can think about it as map from lambda 2 to lambda 2, if you view it in this way. Then as a map, you can decompose both the where it acts in lambda plus, lambda minus, and the result in lambda plus, lambda minus. And this gives us decomposition into self-dual, anti-self-dual parts. So we just take, to see what this decomposition is like, we just take projectors, right? We think about Riemann as this map, and then let me introduce the A part. It is the self-dual, this guy is self-dual, self-dual part. We just apply P plus on both sides of Riemann map. P plus concretely is identity plus epsilon, and you just work out what it is. In particular, you will need to work out what, you know, that product of two epsilons is lots of conical deltas. So if you decompose the product of two epsilons appearing here into conical deltas, you find that, well, actually the result here is just this. P plus applied to Riemann is the same as P plus applied to Weyl plus the Ricci scalar. So basically, this projection just selects the Weyl part, and moreover, only the self-dual part of Weyl curvature tensor is selected. So A, the self-dual part is Weyl, the self-dual part of Weyl plus the Ricci scalar. Similarly, anti-self-dual is the anti-self-dual part of Weyl plus the Ricci scalar. And the fact that it's the same Ricci scalar appears here, this is consequence of Bianchi identity. The fact that full anti-symmetrization of Riemann is equal to zero, it tells you that it's the same R sitting here. And then you work out what the self-dual, anti-self-dual part is. It's P plus Riemann P minus. And as I'll explain in a second, B just encodes the Ricci trace-free part of. That I will prove for you, because this is essential for my next argument. So we see that Riemann can be viewed as, well, it's a map. It's map that maps six-dimensional space of two forms into six-dimensional space. We can view it as consisting of blocks. A, B, and C are 3x3 blocks. So Riemann has this block structure, A, B, C. We know that here, this block A is just Weyl plus R times the identity. This block here is Weyl minus plus R times the identity. And this block, I didn't prove, but I will prove that this is Ricci trace-free. And so this is what concretely what I said before. If you do self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition of Riemann, it encodes the same information as decomposition into Weyl, Ricci, and the scalar. You see it here explicitly arising. Okay, the next step, let me prove facts about this block B, because they lead to an important statement. So the way I want to prove it, so first calculation will be, I'll just calculate what this P plus Riemann P minus is, and we'll see that basically vanishing of B is the same as, it can be stated, B is equal to zero is equivalent to Riemann commuting with the Hodge star. That's a very nice way of stating it. Let me prove it. So the proof is explicit. You compute P plus Riemann P minus. Well, you want to equate it to zero for reasons I will explain. We want to prove that this block being zero is the same as Riemann commuting with the star. So let's compute it. This is my P plus. This is my P minus. I expand. I get four terms. I get a Riemann. I get 1 over square root of sigma star Riemann minus Riemann star. Remember, Riemann is viewed as a map from lambda 2 to lambda 2. Star is also a map from lambda 2 to lambda 2. And so And well, I also have a term with two stars. It's easiest to see what happens when you are in Lorentzian signature. Then the square root of sigma is I, and then this is the real part of this equation, and this is the imaginary part of this equation. Both must be zero. And you see that, well, this is the imaginary part being equal to zero, this is the real part being equal to zero. Actually, they imply each other. If you multiply one of them by star, so for example, you multiply this by a star, and star squared is sigma, you see that you will get this other equation. So they're actually equivalent equations, and this is why you get the statement that these, the B block, this is my B, the B block being equal to zero is the same as Riemann commuting with the star. And now I'll prove another statement. The other statement is that a Riemann commuting with the star is equivalent to my Einstein condition. That is also easy to prove. Probably what I do here, I think I multiply this by another star, say from the left. Yeah, I think I multiply it by another star, so I get the equation Riemann is is depending on maybe it's sigma star Riemann star. I think I take this equation. Then star involves this is the epsilon, and whenever I have two epsilons, this is a bunch of Kronecker deltas. I expand all this, I get this equation here, and by taking single trace, I get this equation. So this equation implies this, but of course this also implies that. So therefore we see that at the end of the day, B equal to zero is equivalent to the statement that Riemann commutes with a star, but is also equivalent to R mu being proportional to G mu, and which is the Einstein condition. Okay, so this is the statement that I want to make here. A metric is Einstein if and only if Riemann tensor viewed as an endomorphism of lambda 2 commutes with the Hodge star. This is one very nice statement one can make. Very nice, yes?
Sorry, so you showed the trace-free part of Ricci is zero?
Yes.
Does that imply that?
It implies that Ricci is proportional to G mu. It doesn't tell you anything about the scalar, but actually one of Bianchi identities tells you that that is, must be a scalar.
Okay. Yep.
It doesn't tell you what the value of this is, but it tells you that, well, your metric is R mu proportional to G mu with a constant. Well, as I said, constant is implied by something else, by Bianchi identity, the fact that this is a constant. Okay, so, and therefore, we see that to impose Einstein condition, we can look at this matrix of Riemann in block form. And what we need is just to say that B is equal to zero. That's our Einstein condition. It's equivalent way of imposing Einstein condition. But then this block of Riemann, we can have access to it if we have access to the first row of Riemann. So the point here is that we don't need to know all of Riemann to impose Einstein. We just need half of it. And this half is the self-dual projection of Riemann. So because this line here is just you take Riemann, and you apply P plus projector, say, on one side. So it's the self-dual part of Riemann. One-sided self-dual part of Riemann is enough to impose Einstein condition. And then we make a few more steps. Now it's convenient to go to our tetrad formalism and the spin connection, because we know that the curvature of the spin connection is encodes Riemann, right? We know that this R mu nu ij of the spin connection is basically Riemann. If you convert these two indices into space-time indices via the frame field, this becomes Riemann. Therefore, we know from the previous argument that what we need to impose Einstein equations is just a self-dual projection, let's say, with respect to these two indices. we will get access to half of Riemann by projecting on self-dual part with respect to IJ. So this is the projection with respect to IJ. I just apply the self-dual projector with respect to this internal indices IJ. But then, because my Lie algebra of Lorentz group splits into self-dual anti-self-dual parts, projecting the curvature on the self-dual part of Lie algebra is the same as projecting the connection. So self-dual part of the curvature of the spin connection is equal to the curvature of the self-dual part of the spin connection. That's the relation. So you see, this is the explanation why it's okay, why it's enough for me to only have access to the self-dual part of the spin connection. I don't need more, because I just need the curvature of the self-dual part of the spin connection, and then I can impose my Einstein condition. Okay, and therefore, this is the reason why such a chiral formalism is possible. And there is one more explanation I can give for the existence of chiral formalism. That's explanation at the level of the action. So remember that my action in Einstein-Cartan is of this form. It's the kinetic term. I have frame, star, r, where this is the internal, this is the epsilon, I, j, k, l. So this is my kinetic term in Einstein-Cartan. But I can always add to it multiple of frame, star squared r. Because star squared is identity, I'm adding really multiple of frame, r, which by integration by parts is the same as torsion squared. So by adding torsion squared, I'm not changing the theory, because when torsion is zero, I'm adding zero. So basically, I'm adding a boundary term here to the action. And this boundary term is of this form. It's frame, star squared r. But you see, my self-dual projector is a linear combination of star and star squared, which is the identity. So I can adjust the coefficient in front of this term to get a self-dual projector here. This argument tells me that if I take this action, which I call the chiral action, I can for free insert the self-dual projector in my theory. And what I'm doing by doing that, I'm just adding a topological boundary term. People look puzzled by this. But, again, what I'm doing is I'm just adding multiple of this torsion squared, which is a multiple of EIJRIJ. And I'm adjusting the coefficient here so that I get a self-dual projector inserted between EE and R. So I can write my Einstein-Cartan in this chiral way. And I'm not changing the theory, because I'm just adding a boundary term. But as I explained, the self-dual projection of R is the same as R of the self-dual projection of the connection, because Lie algebra splits into self-dual, anti-self-dual parts. All this can be verified by doing some little calculations. I'm not doing that in front of you, but all these statements are really just exercises, which one can check these statements by explicit calculations. And so you get this form of the Lagrangian, and I'll call this a chiral Lagrangian, because now it involves only half of the spin connection. Basically, we eliminated, by doing some integration by parts, we eliminated half of the spin connection from the Einstein-Cartan Lagrangian. That's what.
Is this term zero if you have the full, if you're not self-dual? Like, normally in metric variables, what would that term look like?
I think this is it. So.
The torsion vanish.
And when torsion vanishes, it would be. Well, it's okay, you said it's like the torsion.
So. I'm adding torsion squared. This is what I'm adding. I'm adding this, which is torsion squared. This is torsion squared modulo a boundary term. So I'm not adding zero here. I'm adding a boundary term to the action. Plus torsion squared.
Oh. It's like F wedge F term.
Yeah, F wedge F I will explain in a second. But let me, so my next slide is Jan Mills. But that I'll explain in a second. But let me first make some comments on this. So why is it a good idea? You see, I convinced you that just from the decompositions of Riemann, it's enough to have access to half of Riemann. And therefore, well, and half of Riemann is curvature of the half of the connection. So there is some formalism which only needs half of the connection. And well, it's here, it's in front of you. I can, by doing integration by parts, I can get rid of the half of the connection in the Einstein-Cartan action. And this is a good idea because it halves the number of these momenta variables. The self-dual part of the spin connection has just 12 components. It's half of the components of all of spin connection. And now we have 16 components sitting in the frame, 12 components sitting in the spin connection. And now the difference between them, between these two numbers, is just due to gauge. One can do analysis and check that there are no second-class constraints in this chiral version of Einstein-Cartan. This is very beautiful. We have introduced just the right number of variables to have a nice first-order formulation of the theory, and the variables that are not needed for that, we haven't introduced. So that's the beauty of it. And of course, there is some price to pay for the economy. The action is not manifestly real in Lorentzian signature because it starts to involve the square root of sigma sitting in front. So the action is not manifestly real because what I've added, I've actually added an imaginary term to my Lagrangian. It's not manifestly real, but then I'll compare it to something else that maybe is more known.
Sorry.
Yes.
These final results are all on shell, right?
No. No, this is just Lagrangian formulation. Nothing is on shell. No equations of motion are imposed.
Well, you require it to be an Einstein space. That's
all. Well, I've explained why doing something and imposing condition on. No, not really. The logic is that
on shell. The second part is off shell.
Well, the logic, look. This is decomposition of Riemann. Of course, it's a Riemann of a metric compatible connection. And it's very important for me, for purposes of what I've explained later, is the statement that B is equal to zero. This part of the Riemann matrix equal to zero is the same as Ricci proportional to the metric. So B is equal to zero is your Einstein equation. Of course, I want to impose Einstein equation, and I'm explaining that I can do this by just looking at the first line of this matrix.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that you can go in one of the two sectors in the chiral theory by imposing Einstein equation. If you don't do that, can you do what you did at the end of the story without imposing B equals zero?
I'm not imposing anything here. I'm saying that I can take full Einstein-Cartan, do integration by parts in it, and rewrite it as that, which only involves half of the spin connection, plus some torsion squared type term. And after that, when I impose my torsion free condition, or rather when it gets imposed automatically by its field equation, that torsion squared term vanishes. So I'm not imposing any field equations by hand. I'm just doing transformations at the level of the action. No field equations are used. But let me explain, there is an analogy between this procedure and Jan-Mills. And I think I'll explain that and then stop before lunch. So Jan-Mills Lagrangian is square of F mu. However, we can always add to it a multiple of the Pantryagin class of the bundle. We can add epsilon, well, basically trace F which F can be added. Right? This is a total derivative. It doesn't change field equations. It can always be added without changing the theory. But what we have here, we have, well, this metric contraction, F mu, this is, of course, the same as F mu, F rho sigma, and then you have G mu rho, G nu sigma, well, maybe anti-symmetrized. So that's what it is. When I add to my Lagrangian this term involving epsilon, this GG plus epsilon, I can adjust the coefficient in front of epsilon so that I get a projection on the self-dual part. So you see that I can write my Jan-Mills Lagrangian, I can insert the projector on the self-dual part there. I can write it as F self dual part of squared. This gives me a good description of Jan Mills. What I've added there is a topological term with an imaginary coefficient in front of it in Lorentzian signature. And this is a chiral Lagrangian. I want to say that it's completely equivalent to what I'm doing at the level of gravity. It becomes even more equivalent if I consider the first order formulation of this chiral F squared. The first order formulation of this F self dual squared is this. There is additional two-form field, which is required to be self-dual. So you write B mu nu F and B self-dual, and then you write B squared term. As I said, it's very important that this guy is self-dual. Otherwise, you wouldn't get, if you don't impose it to be self-dual, you will also get Jan Mills by integrating it out, but you will not get the chiral Jan Mills. And so if you integrate B out, the field equation that you get by varying with respect to B is F self-dual part of is B. And then you substitute it back, you get this becomes F self-dual part of squared. And so this is a first order chiral description of Jan Mills. Actually, it's a very good Lagrangian to work with. It leads to nice perturbation theory. It's very, very beautiful Lagrangian. I can talk more about it, but I will not. And chiral Einstein-Hilbert, chiral Einstein-Cartan is just the gravitation analog of this chiral Jan Mills. And maybe the last comment is that, as in the Jan Mills case, this chiral Einstein-Cartan leads to an interesting perturbative expansion. It gives you nice perturbation theory, because there are no second-class constraints. It's after you gauge fix, you really get a very nice perturbation theory out of it. I think I'll stop here.